First of all, let me say thank you again for your prayers. I covet them every week, especially the weeks that I get to stand up here and preach before you. So thank you, and I ask that you continue to do so. From the womb, from the very beginning, Jacob was a schemer. Jacob was named for what happened at his birth. He was the child who grasped his twin Esau by the heel as they both entered the world together. We know it proved to be an omen in the lives of both Esau and Jacob. Jacob had always been on the heels of Esau growing up, and yet he'd always found a way to come out on top. He cheated his brother out of the birthright, taking advantage of his brother's stupidity and his appetite, trading him a bowl of stew for the rights of the firstborn. Then in like manner, Jacob was able to find a way also to deceive his father with his mother's help, taking advantage of the old man's eyes and in disguise, able to carry away the blessing of the line of promise that Isaac had intended for Esau. Now in Esau's rage, Jacob realized he could no longer dwell in the strife, in this strife that he had caused between him and his brother. And so we know he fled to his uncle, to the land of Padan Aram. So while Esau dreamt of murder, Jacob was sent out alone. And after meeting God in the wilderness, seeing the stairway or the ladder to heaven, he found his grandfather's family, and he was able to build a new life. First being schemed himself by his uncle to take two daughters instead of just one. And then second, Jacob was able to build up the flocks that he was in charge of until he and Laban could no longer live or dwell together in the same land. Now they schemed each other back and forth, but Jacob again came out on top. And even in his flight from Laban, Jacob was able, by God's miraculous hand, to get away. God was intervening this whole time. But Jacob's strife with men seemed to continue with what seems like little consequence. And as Jacob begins to head back toward the land of promise, toward his home, even though it's clear that God has blessed him and God is on his side, Jacob fears the reckoning that is to come with Esau. Esau is strong, and he's now the lord of the land. There's no getting around this. Jacob, in his fear, relies once again on his wit and his own scheming to come up with some plan. So he decides to split up the camp, thinking that at least if Esau comes to destroy him, then perhaps Leah and Rachel and the children can make it out alive. And in his moment of fear, as we heard about the last time we were in Genesis, Jacob prays to God, acknowledging his own unworthiness and need of God, asking him for deliverance from the hand of Esau. He cites God's own promises back to God, hoping that he would remember and be faithful to the blessing that he'd originally given to Abraham. But then in the very next moment, Jacob sends these waves and these waves and waves of peace offerings to Esau, hoping, even though he's prayed, hoping that these gifts will be enough to make up for the stolen promises. Maybe just one more scheme will work. But Jacob, I think, knows in his heart of hearts that it will not work. That no matter how much cattle he sends, no matter how much stuff he sends to Esau, it's not going to make up for what he had done. Nothing Jacob could do would appease Esau. And the night that he sends out these gifts of livestock, he takes his wives and his children, everything that's left to them. We read they cross the river Jabbok, which sounds a lot like Jacob, and even more so in the Hebrew. The river winding back and forth across the land. A fitting image for Jacob's own life, both in his travels around the country and in his character. He, like the river, has ran his course around and around through the lives, through the blessings, and through the possessions of various men and women, family, wives, children, servants, livestock. And just as the river's course, just as the Jabbok eventually ends, spilling all of its contents into the Dead Sea, so Jacob seems to have reached his end at this point. In verse 24, we read, the weight of loneliness seems to rest on the shoulders of this man who has probably come to this, to the end of his life. I can imagine the thoughts of Esau and his company of 400 men just pressing in on Jacob as he sits alone and he's contemplating what to do all alone in the darkness. And he's thinking, perhaps, how will Esau come? How is this going to go down? Will Rachel, my beloved, will Joseph, her only child, make it out alive? Will God answer? Will God answer any of my prayers? And as he sits alone in this darkness, without any warning, the text says, there's a man with Jacob. And suddenly in the darkness, this unknown assailant is grappling with Jacob. And all we get from the text is that the fight lasts all night. Can you imagine? Can you imagine what Jacob was thinking, what he was feeling in this moment as he's wrestling and grappling with this unknown man? I mean, he's probably not having too many thoughts beyond just survival. Get through this. And so they wrestled until the breaking of the day. Now, I'm a pretty young guy, and I can take my almost 4-year-old in a wrestling match probably for a good 10 to 15 minutes before I get too winded. I'm working on it. But Jacob was wrestling, not a 4-year-old, but what appeared to be a very equal match as they struggled through the sweat and the failing strength in a deep, deep darkness all night long. Over and over again, neither man budges, neither will be beaten. And although the text is silent on this point, I wonder if through the struggle he began to hope that the man who was not prevailing, as the text says, the man is not prevailing. I wonder if he thought, maybe this man can be beaten. Maybe I can do it again, right? He's done it his whole life. He's found a way to scheme, to plot, and wriggle his way out of each situation that he's come to. The unknown man is not prevailing. Maybe. Jacob can muscle his way out of this one too. Whatever he was thinking, whatever he was hoping for, any thoughts that he would triumph over his opponent were crushed in the moment the man reaches out and touches Jacob's hip. Maybe it was a hard hit. Maybe it was just a skillfully placed strike. Or perhaps what I think, it was just a supernatural touch that crippled Jacob permanently. You see, when you're wrestling, if you've ever done it at any point in your life, you know that you depend upon your pivot point, your hips. And in a moment, in that one moment, Jacob is now completely disabled. There is no hope of victory. And Jacob realizes that he is not wrestling with Esau. He's not wrestling with a servant of Esau or a soldier. He's not wrestling with any mortal being. Jacob is wrestling with God. But Jacob isn't really wrestling, though, is he? I mean, he can't. He's physically unable to continue the grappling. Jacob is not wrestling anymore. He's clinging to this theophany, to holding on for his very life. It's not a struggle anymore. It's just a desperate last attempt, an appeal for compassion. As a man says to Jacob, "Let me go, for the day has broken." It's not a stubborn-willed statement that Jacob makes of, you better bless me, God. I'm going to keep hanging on until you bless me. No. It's a tearful plea. How do we know that? In the book of Hosea, chapter 12, verse 4, this is what the author says. Jacob strove with the angel and prevailed. He wept and sought his favor. It's not as though Jacob got the best of God. That doesn't happen. It's that God had mercy on his broken child who was weeping for his grace. When he says, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." What a picture this short passage paints of the nature of God and the nature of man. God and Jacob struggling together. God's patience ever holding up through the fight. And Jacob, totally disabled, hanging by the last thread to a hope that his opponent, that God will for some reason show this unworthy sinner some blessing. And God asked Jacob, he asks him, "What is your name?" In those four words, there is so much meaning and so much more than just what it appears to be. Because our God, the only living and omniscient, all-knowing God, does not ask questions because he lacks information. God asks these things to reveal the heart of man. Just as in the garden with Adam and Eve when God said, "Where are you?" It was not God trying to find the location of his children. He knows. He's seeking to reveal the sin within. And so when God asks, "What is your name?" it forces Jacob to acknowledge and to embrace his own brokenness. In his name, Jacob doesn't just simply answer the question. It's a confession. He's a schemer. He's a heel grabber. He's a cheater. And ultimately, like every one of us, he's a sinner. As Alan Ross says, here, the heel catcher was crippled and had to identify his true nature before he could be blessed. There's no more running for Jacob. It's time to reckon with Esau, and it's time to reckon with God. God, the one who guides his sons and daughters through the courses of their lives, just as he guides the rivers through the earth. And God replies, "Your name shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel, for you have striven with God and with men and have prevailed." It's as though God says, "Yes, you are Jacob. You are a deceiver and a schemer, but no longer. For as you have fought so hard against me and against others, I too have been striving with you. I have been with you every step of the way, and I have not left your side, nor will I ever. I will bless you, and you will prevail because of that. Your children will be blessed through strife and through suffering. They will, like Paul, kick hard against the goads. They will rebel, and they will run away time and time again. But I will continue to strive with my bride and go after her as Israel, the nation, continued on her winding path through history." And so Jacob responds to this new name by pleading in return with the same request that God had made. He says, "Please tell me your name. Please reveal to me who you are. Please reveal to me your nature. Show me yourself." And just as God often does throughout Scripture and in our own lives as well, his character is clear. But God is still so much a mystery. For the infinite God cannot be fully comprehended by finite minds like yours and like mine and like Jacob's. God says, why is it that you ask my name? And that's it. That's all he says. How rich are the mysteries of God? How amazing that just in a name, God can in one moment reveal our hearts and in the next bring us to our knees in humility as we try to comprehend the fullness of who it is that we worship. And Jacob, who had been the victor throughout his life, who was successful, who was rich, finally found that the greatest thing he could ever obtain in his life came through the crippling grace of God. His greatest victory was a defeat. And the blessing came not through his strength, but through his tears. Because there, alone and immobilized, God blessed Jacob. Not because Jacob out-wrestled God, but because God chose to deliver Jacob in his mercy. Right, that's why Jacob goes on to name the place Peniel, because his life had been delivered from and to the hand of the Almighty. Face to face in the dark, Jacob survived the love, the crippling love of God. And for the rest of his life and throughout the traditions of Israel, the touch of God would never, ever be forgotten. The implications in this story just abound. God is so good to us. God is so good, and I am not. Read your Bible. Read throughout the rest of the Old Testament and see how God continued to strive, not only with Jacob, but with his descendants, with the nation of Israel. Because that's a legitimate interpretation of the name Israel. It doesn't just mean that he strives with God, but also that God strives. And how God strived with them. God strived with Israel through the hundreds of years of slavery in Egypt through the Exodus, how he strove and was patient through the leading of Moses in the wilderness, how he was patient with Israel as they entered the promised land with Joshua as their head, as they descended into idolatry once they got there again and again and again, but time and time again he provided the judges to lead them back. Years and years and years. Israel asked for a king, and he showed them their own stubborn pride in the heart of Saul. But then he gave them the shepherd king, David, to show them what it looks like to be a man after his own heart. His patience and love extended through the broken line of David, through the kings, all of them, sinful, despicable, occasionally a good one, but the broken line, he leads them. And although he led the broken kingdom eventually as the kingdom split, and he led one into Assyria and one into Babylon into captivity, he eventually brought them back again. He brought them back to Jerusalem. And finally, we get to the New Testament because he had promised it from the beginning. He became flesh. God himself became flesh and dwelt among us, named in ages past Emmanuel, which means God with us. And how Emmanuel, how Jesus strove with his disciples and with his followers, how he gave himself up for his enemies and forgave from the cross with his dying breaths we who had put him there. But the strife of death was not enough to break our God, because he rose, and it is through his death, through the crippling of God, and through Christ's resurrection that we might be made children of God. And so I declare the good news of Christ to you this morning, because this is the gospel message in Jacob's life. This is how you and I come to faith. This is how we are saved. It is not of our own doing, just as Jacob's blessing was not of his own doing. In the darkness, he did not seek God, but God came upon him and took him down to the ground, rough, wild, and gritty. To follow Christ is not an easy task. It's not something that you do alone, but it is something that requires your entire life. Right? When Jesus said in Luke chapter 14, verses 26 through 33, he said, "If anyone comes to me and does not hate his own father and mother and wife and children and brothers and sisters, yes, and even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. Whoever does not bear his own cross and come after me cannot be my disciple. For which of you, desiring to build a tower, does not first sit down and count the cost, whether he has enough to complete it? Otherwise, when he has laid a foundation and is not able to finish, all who see it begin to mock him, saying, 'This man began to build and was not able to finish.' Or what king going out to encounter another king in war will not sit down first and deliberate whether he is able with 10,000 to meet him who comes against him with 20,000? And if not, while the other is yet a great way off, he sends a delegation and asks for terms of peace. So therefore, any one of you who does not renounce all that he has cannot be my disciple." You and me, like Jacob, have to give it up. You have to lose yourself. You have to renounce your sinful identity, your name, and turn instead to embrace the Father who strives with you to make you his own. I don't know if you know the story of Christopher Hitchens, who was a pretty famous atheist apologist, I guess, if you want to call him that. Pretty famous in Christian circles for going around with Douglas Wilson and debating with him. He got cancer, and toward the end of his life, he wrote article after article about his deathbed and the possibility that he might have a deathbed conversion. And he wanted to make it very clear that as he was on his deathbed, if he uttered even a word that sounded like he was going to follow after Christ, he wanted it to be made known that he would not be in his right mind, and it would not be the Christopher Hitchens that everybody knew that was speaking in that moment, that he was already dead. And what's funny, I think, coming from an atheist, is that he was right. That's exactly right. That's exactly what happens to every one of us. Every one of us. We aren't. When you become a Christian, you aren't your old self anymore. That old self, that old, is gone. It's dead. That's why Christ died, so that you would be made new instead. And like Jacob, you and I must be broken in order to be healed. Right? This is like the story of Job, who lost everything. This is like the story of Peter, who denied Christ before a little servant girl. This is like the story of Paul persecuting Christians. This is the story of the prodigal son sitting among the swine. The story of me as I see God striving and breaking me day by day, slowly and painfully pruning away the parts of me that bear no fruit. Just as a broken bone must often be broken again to set it right, you and I are already broken in our sin, and we must be broken again to set us right. I think one of the most beautiful pictures of this type of love, this type of grace that cripples us and makes us new, was best put by C.S. Lewis in his book, The Voyage of the Dawn Treader. And I just want to read a little bit of that to you this morning. If you've never read The Chronicles of Narnia, what a great story it is, and what great pictures they have of the gospel. In this particular story, this is a character named Eustace, who is one of the cousins of the original four humans that entered into this fantasy land called Narnia. And in this particular story, Jesus Christ is represented by a lion. Right? He's known in the Bible as the Lion of Judah. So Lewis represented him as a lion in his stories, a lion called Aslan. And in this story, Eustace, who represents every one of us, finds a cave of gold and of jewels, and he crawls into the cave. And in the cave, he finds a little bracelet that he slides up on his arm, and he sleeps the night in the cave. And in the morning, he finds that his greed has transformed him into a dragon. And now he's got this bracelet on his arm that's cutting through his flesh, and it's painful and a reminder of his own sinfulness. And as he goes throughout the story, he's looking for the solution. He's trying to find a way to become a boy again, and he can't. Eventually, something happens, and he comes back a boy. And he's talking to his cousins, and he's telling them the story of what happened. And he says this. I'm going to read a bit of this, so do your best to follow along. And Eustace says, "Well, anyway, I looked up and I saw the very last thing I expected. I saw a huge lion coming slowly towards me. And one queer thing was that there was no moon last night, but there was moonlight where the lion was. So it came nearer and nearer, and I was terribly afraid of it. You may think that being a dragon, I could have knocked any lion out easily enough, but it wasn't that kind of fear. I wasn't afraid of it eating me. I was just afraid of it, if you can understand. Well, it came closer up to me and looked straight into my eyes, and I shut my eyes tight. But that wasn't any good because it told me to follow it."
"You mean it spoke?"
"I don't know. Now that you mention it, I don't think it did, but it told me all the same. And I knew I'd have to do what it told me. So I got up and followed it. And it led me a long way into the mountains. And there was always this moonlight over and round the lion wherever he went. So at last we came to the top of a mountain I'd never seen before. And on the top of this mountain there was a garden, trees and fruit and everything. In the middle of it there was a well. I knew it was a well because you could see the water bubbling up from the bottom of it. But it was a lot bigger than most wells, like a very big round bath with marble steps going down into it. The water was as clear as anything. And I thought if I could get in there and bathe, it would ease the pain in my leg. But the lion told me I must undress first. Mind you, I don't know if he said any words out loud or not. I was just going to say that I couldn't undress because I hadn't any clothes on when I suddenly thought that dragons are snaky sort of things and snakes can cast their skins. Oh, of course, thought I, that's what the lion means. So I started scratching myself and my scales began coming off all over the place. And then I scratched a little deeper. Instead of just scales coming off here and there, my whole skin started peeling off beautifully, like it does after an illness or as if I was a banana. In a minute or two, I just stepped out of it. I could see it lying there beside me looking rather nasty. It was a most lovely feeling. So I started to go down into the well for my bath. But just as I was going to put my foot into the water, I looked down and saw that it was all hard and rough and wrinkled and scaly just as it had been before. "Well, that's all right," said I. "It only means I had another smaller suit on underneath the first one, and I'll have to get out of it too." So I scratched and tore, and this underskin peeled off beautifully, and out I stepped and left it lying beside the other one and went down to the well for my bath. Well, exactly the same thing happened again. And I thought to myself, "Oh dear, however many skins have I got to take off?" For I was longing to bathe my leg. So I scratched away for the third time and got off a third skin, just like the two others, and stepped out of it. But as soon as I looked at myself in the water, I knew it had been no good. Then the lion said, but I don't know if it spoke, "You will have to let me undress you." I was afraid of his claws, I can tell you, but I was pretty nearly desperate now. So I just lay flat down on my back to let him do it. The very first tear he made was so deep that I thought it had gone right into my heart. And when he began pulling the skin off, it hurt worse than anything I've ever felt. The only thing that made me able to bear it was just the pleasure of feeling the stuff peel off. You know, if you've ever picked the scab of a sore place, it hurts like billy-o, but it is such fun to see it coming away. Well, he peeled the beastly stuff right off, just as I thought I'd done it myself the other three times, only they hadn't hurt. And there it was, lying on the grass, only ever so much thicker and darker and more knobbly looking than the others had been. And there was I, as smooth and soft as a peeled switch, and smaller than I had been. Then he caught hold of me. I didn't like that much, for I was very tender underneath now that I had no skin on, and he threw me into the water. It smarted like anything, but only for a moment. After that, it became perfectly delicious. And as soon as I started swimming and splashing, I found that all the pain had gone from my arm. And then I saw why. I'd been turned into a boy again. And after a bit, the lion took me out and dressed me. I don't remember exactly that bit, but he did somehow or other in new clothes, the same as I've got on now. And suddenly I was back here. I read that every time, and I'm just reminded again of my own conversion and my own experience with that very same type of feeling of God reaching down and pulling away my old self and making me new through the waters of baptism. I again call you to Christ this morning. If you have not been broken by the great God and clothed in His righteousness, then, as Jacob did, as the Spirit of God wrestles your heart within you, I pray, cling to Him as Jacob did, and pray that He blesses you even as you are tossed about. If you're a Christian this morning, you can pray that too, because the struggle of sanctification continues. We are being made more and more and more like Him. And as we receive more and more of His crippling grace, may the glory of God abound as much as His grace to us does. Oh, may He be glorified in my pain and in my struggle. May I, like Paul, understand the power of Christ rests upon me when I am weak. Three times, Paul, going back to 2 Corinthians, three times I pleaded with the Lord about this, that the thorn in the flesh should leave me. But He said to me, "My grace is sufficient for you, for My power is made perfect in weakness. Therefore, I will boast all the more gladly of my weaknesses, so that the power of Christ may rest upon me. For the sake of Christ, then, I am content. I am content with weaknesses, insults, hardships, persecutions, and calamities." And at this point, as you're reading this and you're hearing this, you might as well throw in your own circumstances, your trials, your tribulations, right? Your struggle at work, your struggle at home, your broken relationships, the struggle with your children, the struggle with your lack of children, the struggle with your spouse, the struggle with your lack of spouse, whatever it is. "For when I am weak, then I am strong." As I pray you've been thinking about Rick's call to be a gospel-centered community in the past few weeks, perhaps you, like me, have looked at your life and seen just how much you're lacking. How much you lack in all these areas of evangelism and of discipleship, of prayer, even of love. Maybe like me, you're ashamed. You're weak. But beloved, that's exactly where God is going to use you. Like Jacob, may each painful step that you take remind you that God is making you new. That He is blessing you and He is preparing you for the hope yet to come. Yes, embrace how God has made you, whatever circumstance, whatever position you're in. Embrace how God has made you, how he is remaking you, how he is conforming you to his Son, and how in the midst of the mundane, he uses broken sinners. He uses you and me to be his church. It's not in vain that you limp along. It's not in vain that he gives us his word and tells us to go forth. We too, like Jacob, have the blessing of God upon us through Christ. As Isaiah prophesied, and I'll leave you with this. Isaiah said, "For as the rain and the snow come down from heaven and do not return there, but water the earth, making it bring forth and sprout, giving seed to the sower and bread to the eater, so shall my word be that goes out from my mouth. It shall not return to me empty, but it shall accomplish that which I purpose and shall succeed in the thing for which I sent it." And hear this encouragement. "For you shall go out in joy and be led forth in peace. The mountains and the hills before you shall break forth into singing, and all the trees of the field shall clap their hands. Instead of the thorn shall come up the cypress. Instead of the briar shall come up the myrtle. And it shall make a name for the Lord, an everlasting sign that shall not be cut off." Come quickly, Lord Jesus.